So good afternoon, and welcome to this afternoon's panel entitled Discrimination, Free Speech and Religious Liberty versus Equality and Respect? Cornell United Religious Work, through its 80 years, it's a rather memorable year for us. This is our 80th anniversary. In addition to nurturing interfaith community over the past 80 years, CRW has been committed to promoting public dialogue and civil engagement around the many issues and concerns that have at times both engaged and at other times divided our campus community and the world at large. Our panel this afternoon intends to engage and invite you all here too to respond to a prevailing trend observed on a growing number of university and college campuses across the country, where student religious groups find themselves under fire because of their school's anti-discrimination policies. In many instances, these particular religious groups seek waivers from the anti-discrimination policies so that they can continue to choose student leaders who subscribe to their beliefs, and by association, to reject those who do not share their beliefs. Student groups, often with help from outside legal organizations, are filing lawsuits, seeking exemptions from these policies. Many colleges have settled, but several more are in or are headed to court. Court decisions have been decidedly mixed from my reading of the literature. Increasingly, these religious groups, usually, though not exclusively, Christian organizations, are becoming obligated on a growing number of private campuses to follow anti-discrimination rules to earn campus recognition, meeting space, and funds from student activity fees. Yet some maintain that they must discriminate because of scriptural injunctions against, for example, homosexual conduct. At stake, say supporters of these groups, are freedom of religion and the right to free association. Waiver opponents, on the other hand, including, although not just including, gay rights organizations and many campus administrators, say that what is at stake at this juncture of history is civil rights for all. According to Religion Link, a web resource group of journalists who seek to write about religion with balance, accuracy, and insight, estimate that by the year 2005, at least 50 such conflicts had arisen since the year 2000 across this country, from community colleges to elite universities at private institutions and public, and there is an increase in new cases. It is not surprising, then, that this conflict or challenge would ultimately find expression on the Cornell campus. As many of you know, last spring, the Cornell campus newspapers, the student assembly, and campus administrators together struggled to respond to an anguished gay student leader who was denied a leadership role in a campus religious community, a campus student organization. As he sought out protection under our campus's anti-discrimination policy. At the same time, students of this same faith community, along with others, felt at times confused and certainly anguished by being branded as intolerant or discriminatory while they were only trying to live out the tenets of their faith. Far from being an academic discussion, as with all of us here last spring, the stakes of this conflict hit very close to the hearts of all those involved. I want to take a moment to applaud the many students and staff, some of whom are here this evening, who took this opportunity last spring to initiate thoughtful debate and dialogue. Unfortunately, the semester ended, though, before we could speak more broadly as a community to what is at stake for our community beyond the particulars of this one case. So we begin again, in a sense, a continuation of that conversation, to consider the challenges these situations will continue to bring to our campus community. After our panelists have been introduced, they will begin a conversation between each other, with some moderation on my part, little moderation. We hope, though, in short fashion, truly in the spirit of dialogue, that we will then be able to invite you here this evening, as you choose, to participate with comments, with questions, with your own reflections, and most importantly, with the questions that still remain for you as you wrestle with this topic. Both within and beyond this evening, our office shares a commitment to continue dialogue within our own association, within Cornell United Religious Work, which comprises 29 member religious communities, and future dialogues proposed by the Dean of Students Office and the LGBT Resource Office. At this time, I feel very privileged to introduce to you, although I suspect he doesn't really need an introduction because he's everywhere on this campus. Rami Salem is from the class of 2010, a college scholar majoring in government and Near East studies, a public service scholar with a great interest in Kenya and HIV education, the president of the Student Assembly. He is also on staff as a student assistant at Keaton House. You shame us, Rami. How can you do all this? Rami, as many of you know, is in beginning his tenure as president of the Student Assembly this year, has spoken passionately about his commitment to getting much more of the student body engaged in student governance on this campus, hoping for a greater sharing of diverse ideas and perspectives, all the while working to create a stronger and more inclusive community. I can't think of a better person to introduce our panelists this evening with the aims of our discussion. Please welcome Rami Salem.
Thank you, Ms. Shortall, for the ego boost. So last spring, as Ms. Shortall mentioned, an issue arose before the Student Assembly involving a student organization, and it was a conflict between the rights of the student organization to choose their membership and the right of the students. After a decision was made that the organization was not in violation of university guidelines, I wondered whether the issue needed to be revisited and whether the conversation should be extended, and also what other universities have done to deal with similar issues, which is why I'm very curious to hear what the speakers have to say in terms of balancing what it means to be a welcoming community in all respects while not infringing on the rights of students. Now, without further ado, I'd like to introduce our speakers. We welcome back to Cornell Dr. Charles C. Haynes, the senior scholar at the First Amendment Center. As many of you know, Dr. Haynes writes and speaks extensively on religious liberty and religion in American public life. Widely quoted in news magazines and major newspapers, including our own Ithaca Journal, Dr. Haynes is also a frequent guest on television and radio. He has been profiled in the Wall Street Journal and on ABC's Evening News. In 2008, he received the Virginia First Freedom Award from the Council of America's First Freedom. The First Amendment Center works to preserve and protect First Amendment freedoms through information and education. The center serves as a forum for the study and exploration of free expression issues, including freedom of speech, of the press and religion, and the rights to assemble and to petition the government. Dr. Haynes is the author or co-author of 6 books, including The First Amendment in Schools and Finding Common Ground, A Guide to Religious Liberty in Public Schools. And this resource was sent by President Bill Clinton to every public school in the US in 2000. And working on this book, he was motivated by the fervent belief that we needed national agreements to provide a safe harbor where communities could reach their own common ground. Dr. Haynes added, "These principles don't belong to lawyers and judges, but to the American people. What is legal is important, but what is right for our communities is more important." His scholarship and work as a trainer and a consultant to educators across the US seeks to foster a civil public school culture where students' religious expression is protected as long as it does not violate the rights of others. He adds, "The intent is to create a unity that is in the interest of our diversity." And we are also proud to have our very own Dr. Steve Schifrin with us today. Stephen H. Schifrin is a professor of law at Cornell Law School. He began his law school teaching career at UCLA in 1977, receiving tenure in 1981. He has been a visiting professor of law at Boston University, at the University of Michigan, and Harvard University. Joining the Cornell faculty in 1987, Professor Schifrin is the author of Dissent, Injustice, and the Meanings of America by Princeton University Press in 1989. 99, of which Georgetown University professor Robin West called a fundamental reorientation of our thinking on the First Amendment and the free speech it protects. She described the 204-page volume as a well-rendered account of an embattled national vision, a vision of what it might mean to be an engaged participant in civic life, to be an independent thinker, and ultimately, to be an American. Professor Shiffrin followed this book with the publication of The First Amendment, Democracy and Romance by Harvard Press, 1990, the winner of the Thomas J. Wilson Award. His writings have appeared in many publications, including the Cornell Law Review, the Harvard Law Review, the Michigan Law Review, the Northwestern Law Review, the UCLA Law Review, and the New York Times Book Review. His new book, The Religious Left and Church-State Relations, was published this fall by Princeton University Press. Please welcome our panelists here this evening.
Where do we begin?
I'm sure Charles will tell us.
Well, I don't know where to begin. Well, I, if somebody has to begin, I'll begin. Thank you for that great introduction. And it's great to be back at Cornell. Thank you for this invitation. I am also honored to be on the same panel with one of the nation's leading First Amendment scholars. It's a little daunting, but I really feel privileged to be with Professor Shiffrin. And this is a very difficult question in some ways, but I'll just say right up front, if somebody has to start, kind of where I am on this, what side I'm on. I'm on both sides. Now, that's not probably what you want to hear. You probably want to hear the CNN, this side versus that side, crossfire. But I really, both sides, what I mean to say is, I really don't think there should be sides. And most of my work and my life has been working in communities that are in deep conflict over issues involving religion and public life. So that's what I've been doing for the last 20 years or so. And I've seen the damage it does when people are so deeply divided over some of the issues that we're talking about today. It tears apart people's lives and community. So I think we need to find a way for there not to be sides. Now, does that mean we can resolve all the issues here and all find common ground and everything? No. There are going to be some unavoidable conflicts on this question of religious liberty and equality. These are two of the most important principles that have shaped us from the beginning in this country. And so when they come into conflict, when there's tension between these two important principles, there are some unavoidable conflicts, there's no question. And we are really on the cusp of a big national conversation. Well, it's already started, but it's only going to get more intense in the coming decade on this cluster of issues. It's across the board. So the backdrop for our discussion today is the very heated debate over same-sex marriage. And what will religious liberty be in a time when same-sex marriage is legal? And in some states, that's already the case. Housing, the workplace, public schools, where I spend most of my time. In all of these arenas, these tensions are getting deeper and deeper. So I think how we address this is very important. It's not just what the issue is that's important for me, it's how we address it. That may be as important as the issue itself. Because at the end of the discussion, we have to still learn how to live with one another with our deepest differences and build a community, in this case a college community, but a national community out of our deep differences, our religious and ideological differences. So how we live together and work together without compromising our deep convictions on any side is a very challenging question. So I'll start with that, putting that on the table, that I think we need to find ways to work through this that protects people's rights on all sides. I happen to think there are some ways, and there are some common ground approaches on some of these things, although, as I say, that doesn't mean that we're going to find common ground on everything. But I think on some of these, there are ways forward that can uphold both of these commitments to religious freedom on one hand and equality on the other.
Well, I too would like to thank the president of the Student Assembly for the very nice introduction. I too am privileged to be on the same panel, not only with Janet, a wonderful spiritual leader and a wonderful instigator of dialogue, but also with Charles, who is clearly a leading public intellectual and a person who has been a peacemaker in public schools across the country and is commonly called in to resolve disputes that have been occurring in those schools. These are skills that I do not have. I'm neither a public intellectual nor a peacemaker. Somebody who writes a book called Dissent, Injustice, and the Meanings of America is more, is a polarizer. Some of the views I will express here are, I will admit, outlier views, not views generally shared, but they're right. I want to start with just a few principles that I have with respect to the subject matter, though I certainly agree with Charles that the way this is discussed is important in every community. First, should a group be able to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation? My answer to that is yes. In terms of the First Amendment, it's protected under both freedom of speech and freedom of religion. So the Boy Scouts, even though I think that case was wrongly decided, can discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. Cornell is not bound by the First Amendment. It's a private school, has to decide for itself what the relationship between speech and religion on the one hand and equality and respect on the other ought to be. Second principle, should speech of a racial character or gender or sexual orientation that is hateful, persecutorial, and degrading be permitted on a college campus? This is where I'm an outlier. My claim is no. Go to the legal counsel's office. They will tell you, the First Amendment, they were raised on it. In Canada, in Europe, generally, hate speech is not permitted. Most Americans have been, are a product of a culture in which we protect the speech we hate, and therefore it ought to be protected. I believe that on a college campus, it creates a hostile environment for students of color, for women who are attacked in this way, and for students of sexual orientation. And it contributes absolutely nothing to public dialogue, and therefore should not be permitted. Third, although I said first that I thought that organizations that discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation should be permitted to exist, I do not think that means that they should be granted subsidies. I initially wanted to take the position that organizations that discriminate in that way should not be granted subsidies at all. But there are complications with that position. I'm comfortable with the notion that in student government, such organizations should not be granted subsidies. One complication of the position is, what's a subsidy? Another complication is that I don't hold this with respect to, for example, Cornell United Religious Work. The campus gives, so far as I know, but if this is not true, let's pretend it is. The campus gives subsidies to Cornell United Religious Work. I'll make up the building there is given for purposes of use, offices, telephones. Maybe there's some charge, I don't know. Pardon me?
An endowment.
An endowment. Should the Catholic Church be thrown out of the building because the Catholic Church discriminates in terms of gender with respect to priests? I don't think so. I'm not very knowledgeable of Islam, but if there's discrimination on the basis of gender there, I feel the same. I don't think Islam should be thrown out of the building. I don't think evangelical Christians should be thrown out of the building. And in my own mind, I have to reconcile why I think that, but think that if the student assembly says, we're not going to give money to groups that discriminate on the basis of religion or sexual orientation, I'm sorry, race or sexual orientation. Religion is very complicated. I'd be happy to discuss it, Charles. Race or sexual orientation, we're just not going to give you money. You can exist. We're not going to give you money. I'm very comfortable with the idea that they ought to be able to do that. Charles.
Oh, gosh. Well, you brought up a lot of important things. And let's see. First, let me say that I think that a religious group needs to be able to choose its leadership because it's a matter of conscience. And liberty of conscience is, in my view, our first liberty, and all liberties flow from that. As the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom starts off, whereas God Almighty hath made the mind free, everything flows from that. Freedom of the mind, freedom of conscience is fundamental. So I don't think we can have a community committed to religious liberty, at which I hope Cornell University is, even if it's not subject to the First Amendment, I hope that there's a commitment to religious freedom that then turns around to a religious group and says, you can't exist on our campus because you select leaders according to a religious test. It's really not discrimination about sexual orientation. It's about whether or not people who have particular commitments, faith commitments, may be chosen to lead a group that has that faith commitment. And I think that they should be allowed to. Now, as to whether or not they receive benefits and so forth, I think they get the same benefits every other group gets, in my view. I mean, I think that the student government, and I was student government president about a million years ago, so I was in that spot. It's tough. You know, you have all these groups. But I don't think it's the student government's decision to say this group or that group has the wrong views about politics, about religion. I think what we have here is a student fund that creates an opportunity for students to form different associations, to have a campus life with people able to express their views, to get together with people of like mind, to carry on certain activities. And that student fund, in my view, should be viewpoint neutral. And, you know, once we start getting into the business of the student government says, well, you know, don't like the views of this group, so I'm not going to, we're going to take the funds away. Is there some line that could be crossed by some group that's formed? Probably so, and I'd be glad to talk about that, where the line is. I'm not sure I have a bright one to draw, but I do think that if it's viewpoint neutral, we encourage the values of freedom of speech, freedom of association on a college campus. It's what a college campus in my university campus is supposed to be, a place where really people are encouraged to express their views. Imagine if we had a policy, and their faith, imagine if we had a policy on a college campus that said, we're for freedom. We're for free speech, freedom of association, we're for equality, we're for all of these values. But guess what? If you are a Christian group, an evangelical Christian group, we're not going to allow you the same access to facilities, the same funds, the same opportunity to carry on your activities as others. So you can be here. I don't know where you'd meet exactly or how you would do it, but you can be here. But you're not going to be treated like everybody else because you're not following our understanding of what equality is. Well, I just think that's, to me, undermines the very values the university is supposed to stand for. So if we want to get down to that, I guess I do have a side on that. I mean, I don't believe that we should have discrimination. And I am for full equal rights. I am actually a supporter of gay marriage. You know, these are things that mean a lot to me personally. But I want it to be debated openly and freely. I want all voices to be heard. I want people of faith and of all faiths or no faith to have an opportunity to really get in the public arena, and in this case, the college arena and university arena, and really have a robust exchange on a level playing field. As for hate speech and speech codes, well, it's great that we're both on this panel so that you do, in fact, have crossfire after all. I'm absolutely opposed to any speech codes on a college campus, university campus. I mean, I can understand anti-harassment policies, and I can see where some kinds of speech, if it's repeated and people can rise to the level of harassment. So I acknowledge that. But speech? My basic problem with speech codes in Europe and the United States, who decides? I mean, the French have passed a law outlawing speech denying the Holocaust, and some other countries have too. I understand that. I mean, if you live in Europe, it's and when I travel there and talk to people about this, of course, you know, if there's one thing you're going to outlaw, it would be Holocaust denial. And so I know my argument is lost on them when I start talking about, you know, putting these people on trial, sending this underground is counterproductive. It's you actually encourage, in my view, Holocaust denial by trying to outlaw it. But they don't hear me. They say, oh, that American, you know, he lets people say anything, you know, they're crazy. But then they wanted to go on from that and more recently, pass a law outlawing any denial of genocide. Oh my gosh. Now, it didn't get through the assembly, the French, it got through one part of the assembly, didn't get, but that's the idea, is that if we really think something is deeply offensive, and it was because of the Armenian genocide issue and so forth, and there was a big lobby to get that outlawed, well, let's have another law tomorrow outlawing anybody who says anything terrible about homosexuals. Oh, that's so offensive. Or on the other side, you know, anybody who says anything in favor of homosexuals, let's have a law about that. Because when you give government the power to decide this, believe me, these hate, so-called hate speech, who decides what's hate is very important and very powerful. So to me, the best answer is that old First Amendment cliche, you know, the best answer to speech you don't like is more speech, not less speech, speech you do like, speech you're in favor of. And that's the best way to counter it, not to send it underground, not to repress it. And college campuses, in my view, should be the last place where we want to start telling people what speech is good and what speech isn't good and what's hateful and what isn't hateful. And I'd be glad to talk about how the ramifications of my position, because I realize it causes a messy discussion sometimes. But I actually believe that these hate speech codes in different college campuses and universities have hurt more than they have helped towards civility. I don't think that there's much evidence that they create a more civil discussion. I think you do that in other ways. So I guess we do have some disagreements after all, but I think we need to look more deeply then at what kind of community we want to have that can protect people on all sides. I do think that in the case of clubs, you know, there is an important discussion about how we treat everyone fairly. And you know, my view is that we have to let it's like the Equal Access Act, how it applies in public schools. We need to let these clubs form and carry out their mission in order to really have a forum that includes all or as many voices as possible.
I think Charles gave an excellent presentation of the traditional view with respect to hate speech. And for the moment, although I have an eloquent response, I am not going to be drawn into that, though I've got lots of notes here and I'll come back to it. Because I think the more interesting discussion that triggered this panel is about what he said at the beginning, which is about, should Christian evangelical groups be able to select their own leadership? And should they, when they select their leadership, be given subsidies by universities? And we're not as far apart as it might appear in this sense. Should Christian evangelical groups be able to select their own leadership? Of course. Should they be able to select their membership, which Charles did not discuss, and I think he has some interesting views on that, which he can elaborate. I believe they should be able to select their own membership, and they should be able to select their own leaders. By the way, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the Court of Appeals which is in charge of New York, although the New York state courts often don't care what the New York Court of what the Second Circuit says. But the Second Circuit had a case involving a Christian evangelical group that was selecting leaders. And they said, in order to be a leader in our group, you have to essentially be a Christian evangelical. And that applied to the president, the vice president, the secretary, the treasurer, and so forth. And the Second Circuit, in a dazzlingly stupid opinion, said, well, you know, it's okay for the president and the vice president, but not for the treasurer and the secretary, because Christian views have nothing to do with how you take notes and so forth. The idea that the Second Circuit should be going into the leadership of an organization and trying to connect what the people are doing with the theology strikes me as incredibly dangerous for the Second Circuit. So we're in agreement on that. The next statement I'm going to make is going to mark me out as a lawyer. But I think Charles is a lawyer too, aren't you? Oh, okay. Well, you think like one. Except you're more eloquent.
I'm not sure that's a compliment.
I agree. You are more eloquent than most lawyers by a long stretch. But there's a technical distinction to be made here. The Sierra Club picks its leaders. And the Sierra Club could say, you're not going to be the leader of the Sierra Club unless you agree with the principles of the Sierra Club. A Christian evangelical group, by the same token, ought to be able to do the same thing. That, and suppose one of the principles of the organization is no sex outside of marriage. I mean, Christian evangelical groups aren't just opposed to same-sex relations, and they think that marriage includes a man and a woman. But that policy, in my view, is not discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. It is rather an ideology. That policy applies to gays and to straights. Both of them they could be excluded. If I were a member of a Christian evangelical organization, I could not be a leader because I couldn't subscribe to their views, and I'm straight. So it strikes me that, this is why this sounds like a technical lawyer's distinction. Is that all I had to do? To get around it? I don't know how the campus policy is written here, But it does strike me that if the campus policy forbids discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, that that isn't discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Two more points. There is an interesting question on the basis of religion. Suppose the campus code forbids discrimination on the basis of religion, so that if the Sierra Club says no Jews can be a member of our organization, obviously that will violate the policy. But suppose the Christian evangelicals discriminate on the basis of religion. No Catholic can be in our group, no Jew in our group. There is a law professor named Eugene Volokh who maintains that religious groups that discriminate on the basis of religion can be denied subsidies in the same way that the Sierra Club can be denied subsidies. Because any group that discriminates on the basis of religion has violated the policy. He admits this has a disproportionate impact on religious groups, but he thinks that disproportionate impact is not enough to make out a free speech case. And he, believe it or not, I'm not going to say that he's for sure right under the doctrine, but it's an incredibly respectable argument under the distorted doctrine that exists in the United States. I'm not with Eugene Volokh on that point. To Charles, I would ask, what about the Ku Klux Klan? If the Ku Klux Klan discriminates against Catholics, Jews, and African Americans, can they get subsidies from the student assembly on the ground of freedom of speech? I don't think they have they actually are religious in the sense that they're Christian. So the second question would be, suppose they say we're doing this as a matter of our Christian conscience. We'll come back to hate speech later.
I mean, as one who supported the right of the KKK to march, you know, in Illinois all those years ago, I think, of course, they should have the right to speak in the public square. They do. Now, on a college campus, a university campus, I think it is a different matter for a number of reasons. One, of course, you'd lose your federal funding, I think, right? I mean, federal funding is connected to non-discrimination on race and gender. And I think we've made a decision in this country that those who are going to receive that funding will uphold those principles of non-discrimination. I do think that, so I think there are some groups that can be disallowed, particularly when it comes to racial discrimination. I think it's a decision that we've made as a country. I do think religious groups are a bit different. I mean, and whether or not the KKK falls as a religious group, I don't think it does. That's a discussion. But I think that, I also think that there's a parade of horribles problem here. I mean, there are lots of other groups we can start talking about, neo-Nazis and so forth. I hope that the likelihood of there being enough Cornell students to form these groups is so small that this is entirely hypothetical. But I suppose it's possible. I do think, however, that when it comes to religious groups of various kinds, we're talking about something a little different than any of the other political or ideological groups, mainly because the First Amendment starts out with protection for religious liberty. Religion is different. I know it's sometimes difficult to know, well, what's religion, what isn't, but putting that aside, religion is different. And it's a matter of conscience to make sure that people of faith are able to freely exercise and practice their faith. It's a matter of conscience because, as Madison argued all those years ago when he argued for religious disestablishment of the church in Virginia, and I'm paraphrasing, but there are many people who have in their lives an authority higher than the state. And the duty of the state really is to protect the rights of people to follow what, not what they want to do or would like to do or interested in doing, what they must do because their conscience requires them. Why I'm so committed to liberty of conscience goes back to that fundamental principle of protecting the right of people to do what they believe their God requires them to do. I think it's our moral responsibility as a society to protect that fundamental right because it's the basis, I think, of so much else, that so many other freedoms, to protect that fundamental right to follow the dictates of your conscience, as our framers used to put it. So I do think religious groups are different. I'm not sure if I have the answers for all the other kind of hate groups that might pop up. I do think we have to be vigilant and think about how to deal with those. But I do think when it comes to religious groups, their freedom of conscience is what I'm concerned, first and foremost, that the policy in the university protect. Their right to follow what their God requires, even if, you know, I disagree with it, even if most people disagree with it. There are many ways in which this country has a long tradition of protecting liberty of conscience for people that lots of other people are offended by, don't agree with. We started early by allowing the Quakers to be exempted from combat. Now, that's not true in much of the rest of the world, but why did we do that? It goes back to our commitment to protect people's right to follow what they feel they must do. You know, and when in the little arena where I work in public schools, these issues get very concrete. If a public school, high school, in many cases now, has a no head coverings policy, you know, because they're afraid of gang warfare and gang colors, I understand that. I mean, I'm not against them having that policy if it helps them fight their gang problem. I think there's a high interest in fighting gang problems in high schools. But to the girl who comes in and says she must cover her head because she feels God requires her to, a Muslim girl, or a boy who comes in and says, I have to wear a yarmulke, or a Sikh who says, I have to wear a turban, I would hope that there was a public school in Oklahoma that said no to those, said, well, you know, the policy applies to everybody, so nobody gets to wear, you know, a head covering. It doesn't matter whether you're a Muslim, a Jew, or, you know, a Yankees fan, whatever. You don't get to wear your cap. But a yarmulke isn't a Yankees cap. Neither is a headscarf. It's a claim of conscience. So we treat it differently. And we tell the kids with the Yankees caps, even though it's a religion to many Yankees fans, I understand that. We tell them, you can't wear that here. But we don't say that to the Jew, to the Muslim, to the Sikh. That's why I love this country so much. We work at this. In France, of course, girls who want to wear the hijab to a state school can't do that. They have to choose between getting this education provided by the state or going against what they feel God requires. They have to choose between God and education. Well, as the Supreme Court said many years ago, that's a cruel choice to which we should not put our citizens. Now, on a college campus, a university campus, I don't think that we want to put a Christian club or any religious club to the cruel choice of choosing between following their conscience, following their God, and you know, otherwise being allowed to form, to meet, to have basic things. I don't really consider it a subsidy. Maybe it is. I consider it just being treated like everybody else. You know, students put their fees in the pot, and then it goes out to various groups. I think it should go out on a very viewpoint-neutral basis, and they get their piece of the pot if they qualify by neutral criteria to be a group. But to have them choose, say, well, you can be here, you can form, but you can't get any benefits of being a club, I think is a violation of conscience.
It may be implicit in what you're already saying, Charles, but we were having a discussion both last spring and also in preparing for this, is that I think you would say, you know, I feel very strongly about discrimination. I think we have anti-discrimination policies in place to enhance our communities, to create a place of welcome to the larger campus community. And when religious liberty is in jeopardy, it becomes a bit of a trump card. You know, it then counters the anti-discrimination policy. And I remember part of what I really took from that conversation is we don't take this step lightly. And I've heard you articulate that sense of the difficult choices or the cruel choice placed to believers where they have to either choose to be a part of the association or to choose to participate in the larger campus climate. But I wonder how you have a conversation where we also hold on to and we take this privilege with a great deal of awareness of what this means for others. Because it seems like when the discussion happens, we stay in one place or the other. If we stay in the place of conscience for religious groups, we hear this anti-discrimination policy out here, and we hear gay student leaders are feeling estranged from communities they want to be a part of, or they feel an obligation to feel a part of. They're back here. How do we contextualize the discussion where we have to hold on to both? And maybe that's the question for all of us here. I know that one of the things I really value of working in religious life at Cornell is within the covenant of religious communities within CRW, we make a number of promises to each other by being an association. And one is that when we're on this campus, we are mindful that we're part of a pluralistic community. So we make a commitment to each other, which isn't necessarily a tenet of any of our individual faiths, that we commit to not only be advocates for each other, but to also oppose any demeaning statements or actions on behalf of any of the communities within our association. So we're called to be in community at a higher level, I think, than in the everyday. The other thing is that we're very clear that when we are representing our communities, that we're very clear with people on campus that we don't just, cold call, you know, just hand out cards to any person coming through. Here's information on my community. Here's a way I want you to believe. That we actually make a commitment to sit behind a table so that people who are coming are respected, that people coming through have we respect personal space so people can make decisions about coming to inquire about our various communities or who we are religiously and spiritually. We do that mindfully because we know that as much as someone might in good faith hand you a card to encourage you to believe in a certain way, we are mindful in the interest of climate on a college campus and the issue of pluralism that puts that student potentially at a disadvantage of being pressured in some way, even if that's not our intention. So we have all kinds of internal conversations we have within religious life. But I haven't heard in the discussion at Cornell that we speak in a way more broadly about what it means to have communities of faith that, you know, that speak with conscience. I think it's not surprising that Cornell does not have anti-gay rallies for 15 years. It's never happened here. I don't think that's just by chance. I think there's something about our campus religious climate that's been mindful of, we're here to be part of a larger community. And if we want to be good community members, we have to always be mindful of that community. But beyond religious communities, I'm not sure I have seen that level of discourse on the college campus that would say, I act in conscience to my beliefs with the full understanding that this may cause distress and pain in others, particularly if they choose to be or want to be or identify within my own community. I wonder, I guess it's to put to our panelists, but people who think, we have a lot of people here, what would it mean to have that kind of campus dialogue that's not the polarizing one that I think is more frequently the outcome of anguish? Did that speak to anybody sitting here about what that means to enter into covenant with each other as a campus community pledged on principles of anti-discrimination? But not only that, Cornell also establishes a climate of what we hope to be as a community. We don't just have anti-discrimination policies. We also have campus rhetoric open doors, open hearts, open minds. We have a good deal of rhetoric from the president on down to talk about what it is that we are pledging as community. But that somehow didn't come into this discussion last spring, and I wonder why. Anybody willing to enter into dialogue with us?
One thing that I would ask as a follow-up is that you mentioned earlier, one aspect is what you're believing. The second is how you address it. Mm-hmm. And so sort of a related question is, how would you suggest the addressing of these various topics so that it goes beyond simply talking at one another, but actual dialogue? What have you seen as helpful in universities or schools that you've been involved in the past that would lead you to suggest?
I think Janet is describing some of the things that I think are important to think about, because I don't think it works to try to legislate this, to try to sort of keep some groups out, some groups in, by some policy or another. If we want genuine pluralism, it means evangelicals, gay and lesbian students. It means everybody has a voice, giving everyone a voice. So the question is, how do you have everyone have a voice and it be really people hear one another, not just shout past one another? And so that's really going to take more work to really create opportunities for people to engage one another. What I've seen work is when the community says, you know, we are really going to make sure that we address, I'm going to do the shorthand here, we address our deep differences honestly and openly. We can do this with civility. The incivility comes when we pretend we don't have deep differences, or we try to say we're tolerant and therefore you're not allowed. Or, you know, we're a religious community on the other side and you're not allowed. Now, in public schools, we have more of an opportunity to create this kind of environment where people all get a voice. Most public schools don't want to do this, but I've seen high schools move towards this. I've seen some colleges move towards this, where they really say, now we're going to have an honest dialogue about these things. Instead of putting a panel on during diversity week, where all the panelists, you know, just are religious leaders talking about diversity, and they all just happen to have the same views on homosexuality, positive. I would be okay. That's my side of the argument. Good, you know, great, gay rights. But in this public school arena, in this effort to really address our differences, that's intolerant, in my view. And also, I think that would, in a public school, be unconstitutional for the school to take sides like that and have certain religious voices on one side but not on the other. A true panel, an honest panel, would be, yes, the Roman Catholic position, the Jewish, different positions, and let's really and civilly engage. If we can model a civil discussion about these deep differences, then I think we can create genuine pluralism where people can deal with one another across these differences. You know, I work with people in very conservative organizations, National Association of Evangelicals, all the way over to People for the American Way, and we've come up with lots of agreements on how to deal with religious issues in public schools. And the civility level is very, very high in these conversations. It can be done, but there need to be ground rules and there needs to be a process. And I think on a university campus, the ground rules of free speech and free exercise of religion, freedom of association, these are the ground rules, but then go on to talk about what are our responsibilities under these ground rules to one another, to guard the rights of other people, even those we disagree with. And having spent a lifetime, and my career has been all about defending the rights of people I deeply disagree with, it sometimes is frustrating and difficult. But really speaking, at the end of the day, it's the only way to create this kind of community that Janet was describing, in my view.
It seems to me that Charles has spoken in favor of free exercise, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of association, but has shortchanged the value of equality and has inflated the infringement on freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, and freedom of association if there are denials of subsidies. Let me give you a few examples. The right to have an abortion is constitutionally protected in the United States. That does not give rise to a right for a subsidy to have an abortion. The right to send your children to private school is protected under the Constitution. That does not give rise to a right to a subsidy. The right to have a Technicolor film is protected. The government need not subsidize Technicolor films. Now let's take this to the campus. Is there a right of freedom of conscience for all students and groups on campus? I say yes. Is there a right of freedom of speech for all students? I say yes. I do not think the freedom of speech right should include the right to engage in hateful, persecutorial, and degrading speech against a historically oppressed minority. I believe that there should be, the hate speech regulation should be narrowly confined, that it should be decided by the same people who regulate the student code in general, but that if it is narrowly confined, there need be no fear that speech that could plausibly be described as hateful, persecutorial, and degrading to a historically oppressed minority is the kind of speech we need in a society. And when I think of the student, particularly freshmen, who are taken, who come here and are here the first week and are then subjected to hateful, degrading speech, it strikes me they're already in a different culture. They're already scared to death. That is not something that should be tolerated in this community. Back to the subsidy point. I said there's something tricky about defining what a subsidy is. I believe that all students and associations, regardless of their views and regardless of whether they should whether they discriminate, should be able to have access to classrooms for meetings and the like. I do not consider that as a subsidy, I consider that as a right. There's always a problem in subsidy discussions as where you draw the baseline. But where Charles and I particularly disagree is whether or not the student body has to fund conferences of such organizations that discriminate in the manner I have described on the basis of sexual orientation or race. And I don't think, by the way, that it's a response to the KKK example to say that you'd lose federal funding. The question is a matter of principle. Why is it that the KKK should be treated differently? I think it's because of the hate speech.
Can I pause just a second? Yeah. Because, Rami, you're here. What criteria does the Student Assembly currently use to fund student organizations? They come before the SFC, which I know is part of the Assembly. What criteria, if any, does the Student Assembly use in making those decisions?
General membership has to be available to all students on campus.
Which is also a requirement of all student organizations, right, Catherine? Registered student organizations have to be open to all students on campus. That's correct.
They just have to have an advisor.
They have to have an advisor?
Yeah, and four students.
And beyond that, it's based on the lobbying ability of each group to make their case for funding.
Right. Well, first year, there's a cap on the funding, but then after that, yeah.
Okay. And what is the fund that the Student Assembly is responsible for dispensing each year?
Every 2 years, we have byline funding for student groups. But aside from that, for SAFC funding, it's about
$3
million.
$3 million.
You have to repeat what you said.
Yeah, I'm trying. So every year, because I know there's two different types of funding. I wish I had you up here, Catherine, because I know you know this as well, too. So every year you dispense. The important thing for me is that we're not talking about little bits of money. It's all from the student activity fees. And then the SAFC, you have byline funding, and you also have
SAFC
funding. Probably don't want to get too complicated. But my question back to Steve, because you were saying the issue of, I thought when you were talking about funds, we're talking about that the student fees that go into the funds that is administered by the student assembly, your argument would be to say, we would like to see only organizations funded by those funds that support the anti-discrimination policies of Cornell.
Not that they support the anti-discrimination policies, but they follow the anti-discrimination policies. And Charles says, you know, they pay their money, therefore they ought to receive money. I say two things in response. They pay their money. If they follow the student assembly's policies, they ought to receive money. And two, in terms of the equality interest, the community feels that student organizations that they do not want their money used to fund organizations that discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or race. Gender, by the way, is way more complicated. The women's basketball team, the fraternities, the sororities, I do think men basketball teams should not exist. That is to say, I'm not saying it should be outlawed. I'm saying they should not able to engage in discrimination. That if a woman can play on the men's basketball team, okay, she ought to be able to do so. But you're right. I do digress. Go ahead, Charles.
Well, earlier, Professor Schifrin said that he didn't think this particular, if I understood you correctly, this particular case we're talking about, where the Christian group discriminated, violated the anti-discrimination policy.
Right.
So you're raising, I guess, another possibility that a group will come along that will say, you know, we won't allow gay and lesbian people to join or to be officers,
or to be leaders.
To be leaders. So another would be a hypothetical. I think we agree that a religious position that says we want our leaders to follow certain creedal positions, that's who we are, in this case an evangelical Christian group, is not or should not be construed to be violating the anti-discrimination policy. If we agree on that, I think we've gotten a long way toward my concern to protect the rights of religious groups to choose their own leaders. And I think they ought to be protected to do that. Now, if we take the further step, I would still, however, hold out for a viewpoint neutral policy, which it sounds like the student assembly has at the moment. There's no ideological test. There's no, you know, sort of, and including the university's anti-discrimination policy is not part of the test. I suppose that would be addressed if it happened by the university, but I think that what I'm looking at is the viewpoint of the groups and whether or not there should be any test there. That I would say no. Now, the anti-discrimination, we'd have to look at what kind of group are we talking about. I don't think religious groups violate this policy, so I, you know, would have to have a hypothetical. I guess the KKK is the hypothetical, if they formed on the campus. And, you know, I don't think the university has to allow them under its anti-discrimination policy, probably as a matter of law and as a matter also of moral commitment. But I do think that the student government should be careful to treat all groups the same, that meet the criteria, have access to facilities and funding and so forth on the same basis. And I think that would probably do it for protecting the religious freedom issues that we started with. I'm not sure, but
I think we agree.
We agree on that part. But I don't want to. Let's go ahead.
Well, I know that for me, even listening, I don't know if this occurred to you sitting in the audience too, is, because of having had the experience of listening to them speak before, it is interesting how the rhetoric or the feel of the conversation shifts when you say, you can be a leader in this organization if you subscribe to the beliefs, the core beliefs or the values of this organization. And one of those for, in this particular instance, was views on homosexuality, but it's other things as well. That feels different, and it sounds different than, you will not be a leader because you're gay. They both get stated, and they're both technically true, but the kind of the core underneath there really shifts when you change the rhetoric. And that feels significant, because who claims the rhetoric is then the key question when these debates erupt. Who controls how we describe the situation? And on a liberal campus, I think this is a particularly challenging one, where it's very quick for the conversation to shut down without trying to hold on to, in this sense, competing rhetoric. But not to dominate this, because it really struck me as we have to remember we're on a liberal campus, that the context of this discussion is very much shaped how it unfolds on a liberal campus, too. But I want to invite, I see, Shawkat, are you trying to get into the conversation? Good. So, Shawkat, people are having a hard time hearing. If you can come. Thank you.
I want to make it more abstract. I like your example about whether a gay leader, whether a gay person.
Could you come closer? I can't hear.
Okay. I like the example of the one you just suggested, Jack, about the difference between, say, you have to subscribe to a certain view and what about a gay person being a leader? I want to go back to something that was said earlier. The thing that's confusing me in all this, even though I agree with everyone, is, and I really do, so I'm on both sides, as it were, is this business about claims of conscience. Because it seems to me that we're privileging certain religious groups or groups that we recognize as having claims of conscience when there are people who, according to their conscience, think things that are really quite horrific. And I think that if I were making the decisions, I would have to try and take a viewpoint-neutral viewpoint, and I don't know how I would do that, because I happen to know lots of people who have views that I find reprehensible. They're views that are part of their belief systems.
But does that not get addressed in a harassment policy? You are free to have all the views you choose to have, but when those views then affect my life in actions, hate speech, then it becomes a more complicated situation,
well,
does
Janet,
it not?
Janet, that's where I think Steve and I disagree. When you drop in hate speech, you drop that
I'm
in.
I'm saying you have to establish very particular criteria to fulfill a such.
It's not about hate speech. I'm concerned purely about views held by people and funding that may go to those groups that may then engage in what you were suggesting, things like a conference. Someone decides to do a conference, and they bring in people who have those same views that are claims of conscience, that are not because they want to hurt people or because they want to demean people, but they happen to be views that are regarded by the larger community as hurtful and demeaning. Then one person stands up and says, I'm hurt and demeaned by this. And then we are stuck because we have, in fact, multiple policies. So we have one set of rules in the dorms and one set of rules for the so-called press, Cornell Daily Sun, The Review, The Progressive, all those things. We have one set of rules within the SAFC. We have one set of rules when President Scorton is talking about the open heart, open mind policy. And there's a reason we have all these different sorts of ground rules, because it's not clear to me that we have just a policy. It's not even clear to me that we need a policy. And what happens is we're operating within these very difficult. We're constantly navigating and trying to decide, which is why when an issue, a flashpoint occurs, it's hard to know what to do. The only part that was of interest to me was what if someone says, my being gay is a claim of conscience. I think that it's better to be gay than to be straight.
So
it's part of the way I'm made. And then if they start using the language and the discourse of the religious groups, because the religious groups have privilege, whether they like it or not. The moment that they can say, Issa Cornell, the moment that they can say, I'm part of the CRW covenant, or I am part of a religious group, or there is a national organization which ordains people in my group, you suddenly are talking with a language of power, which is not the way necessarily that another group might speak, that might be much more.
I think it depends on the context. For example, it is not the case that freedom of conscience is exclusive to religious groups. in the selective service cases, conscientious objectors who said that as a matter of moral obligation, they could not serve in the military and kill people, were excused from the selective service despite the lack of religious views. So freedom of conscience is central, but it is not necessarily religious unless you think that if, as a matter of obligation, moral obligation, you believe something, that that is itself religious. The concept of religion in terms of government speaking is different than the concept of religion with respect to free exercise. Government cannot take the positions on religion. But religion is defined differently in that circumstance. Government can take positions on what moral obligations are. And that is not considered religious for purposes of the Establishment Clause. My point is that I think that if somebody says, I have a moral obligation to be gay, I need to know what context are you talking about. If the university is going to try to restrict people because they are gay, that is a clear violation of their human rights, whether they are gay because of a moral obligation or not. So I think careful attention to the context is important. With respect to the subsidies, it's not my understanding that the student assembly is in the business of examining the ideologies of the groups that it is subsidizing. Much to my regret, in the case of hate speech, if they were subsidizing what I have narrowly defined as hate speech. But it isn't the business of the student assembly to make those judgments. And in fact, it might be unconstitutional if this were a public university, depending on how it was structured for it to be done. On the other final point, when I was on the Board of Education, we dealt with groups that wanted to distribute through teachers materials that would go to students. We took the, and teachers would decide whether it was pedagogically worthwhile or worthwhile for the students. So not all stuff got distributed. And we as a board said, if there's a group that is discriminating on the basis of race or sexual orientation, we will not distribute their materials. In my mind, that was not viewpoint discrimination. It was not an examination of their ideology. It was saying don't discriminate. I'm curious, Charles, about why you have been talking about leaders but not members. And I think we have an odd difference there in which...
Well, I think I actually believe that freedom of association should include the right to choose your membership as far as possible. I also think, though, that in balancing the two values of religious liberty and equality on a college campus or in a public school, that it is a possible common ground approach or solution to say we're going to uphold the value of equality by asking, by requiring our student groups to have open membership, but we are going to protect religious liberty by making sure they can keep their identity if they're a religious group by selecting members that reflect their faith. So I actually think it's one way to address in a setting where we're not looking at the First Amendment, where we're looking at how do we uphold both of these values. It's one way forward. If I had my druthers, I'd probably say I think that the religious group should have membership requirements that reflect its convictions and beliefs. But in the equal access decisions so far, the case you talked about, for example, you know, as long as the schools under the Equal Access Act had open membership, the courts have allowed, to some degree, the groups to choose their leaders. I think it's splitting the baby, perhaps, but I think it's a way forward in certain settings to uphold both values. Let me just say a couple of other things about going back to the issue of hate speech, I think, you know, I would say nice try on hate speech. I mean, you're very articulate. And if it's narrowly drawn, I think it's appealing to say, if we could just carve it out, I would just say, I don't think that we can do that without risking, losing our commitment to free speech. People will come along tomorrow and decide that even in that narrow definition, there are all kinds of speech that we're not going to allow. That's my concern. I do think that, going to your question, I think a little, if I can get back there, and that is, there are some very important compelling interests in a college and university community that may indeed trump other important values, including religious liberty. And certainly, I think racial discrimination could be fall into that category. So there, it's not that conscience claims win, whether they're religious or otherwise. They don't necessarily win. I think, though, they have to be taken seriously and treated differently. They may lose because the interest of the community may be so compelling that it trumps even, you know, the most sincere claim of conscience. After all, we have anti-polygamy laws in this country. I'm not sure that case was rightly decided, but it was decided in the 19th century by the Supreme Court that Congress can pass such laws. So, in that case, conscience was trumped. On the selective service thing, I think so far all we have from the court on that is that the Congress can broaden definition of conscience to include those who have no traditional or recognized organized religion, but who have something like that in their lives. I would like to see that expanded by the Supreme Court to include claims of conscience beyond just explicitly religious claims. I'm not sure we're there yet, and how that would look, I think, is a very difficult question to address. But I'd like to see us move there, because I think claims of conscience are claims of conscience and should be treated that way, protected.
Well, one thing, just the last, before the last several things you said, when you said open membership but leadership chosen within the confines, may be a good solution. I'm not sure that the open membership is as simple as that sounds when you're talking about religious groups. But what I'm
wondering, if they're student organizations.
Sorry?
Specifically, if they're registered as student organizations.
Yeah, right. That was what we're talking about, right? Right. Because there is, it seems to me, an interesting analogy between CURW and HOPE. There are religious groups, I think, on this campus that are not members of CURW.
That's right.
And they're not members because they can't, in conscience, subscribe to the covenant. They, for instance, want to proselytize. If you subscribe to the covenant, you promise not to proselytize. That's a pretty deep belief among many evangelical Christians who, I presume, find a way to subscribe to the covenant, but, you know, accept that. If you don't subscribe to CU, if you don't belong to CURW, you don't get subsidies, right? You don't get a subsidy of belonging to CURW. You don't have an office. I mean, all of those things. You know? So in a way, there is the sort of, right, isn't this a group? We've said, we set up these rules. If you can live within those rules, you're a subsidized religious group on this campus. You're a CURW group. If you can, of course the campus is open to you. It's open to any force group. Anybody can form any group they want. But they're not going to receive the subsidy, or whatever it is, the privilege of belonging to CURW. Is that not at all an analogy here?
An analogy.
To saying, well, the student assembly says, you know, this is our rules. These are the rules for belonging to being a recognized group in the student assembly.
Absolutely. It's a theological litmus test. Sure. It is.
Well,
yeah, I mean, there's no question.
And I
would say that I would revisit that myself.
You would what?
Revisit that. Because I don't think that some groups should be in or out depending on their theological commitment, say, to proselytizing. And I'm not speaking specifically of this arrangement because I'm not familiar, but from what you're saying.
Well, it's because of a very long-held tradition at Cornell for the extraordinary value of frequent interfaith. Like some groups don't believe because they feel they can't pray with other groups. Right. And the value of the exchange of ideas, the opening, listening to one another, the things you've been saying are so important because most small religious groups don't exchange with anybody else. They live only within their own group. They're not contributing to some large conversation about which we're all appreciating one another's differences. They're committed to what they want to be committed to. So CURW is committed to the exchange of ideas, the listening to one another, the seeing where you compromise. That's the value that has made us, but the people who created CURW to do it. And that's an enormous value on this campus.
I would analyze it this way. First of all, I would say, let's imagine it's a public university and that the public university is providing funds to CURW and says, but proselytizing religions are excluded. Certainly a number of courts would just strike it down instantly on the kind of grounds that Charles has given. The way I could see it being upheld is if it isn't an ideological test, it is instead a restriction on a particular form of speech, namely proselytizing. That's very tricky to uphold, but I'm thinking of, there are jurisdictions that would uphold laws, I don't agree with them, against begging on the streets. You know, if somehow proselytizing is defined in a way that amounts to a form of harassment, there's no way that proselytizing per se is harassment. And indeed, my understanding of evangelical Christians' notions of when to proselytize is not you walk into a meeting and introduce yourself and say, I'm a Christian and I think you're going to go to hell if blah, blah, blah. It's only after friendships have been developed that you can be effective, is the notion of many evangelical Christians. But if the notion was that proselytizing is a particularly defined form of conduct that comes close to harassment, that's the only way I could see it possibly being upheld.
Yikes. Let's hope not. I mean, you know, just carve out a whole number of religious groups for whom evangelizing or proselytizing is central, Latter-day Saints and many others. I mean, I don't know that means that there can't be an organization on campus that brings together faith groups and of like mind and who have like values. You know, that to me is a different question than the student government handing out funds to all groups. I think this is an association that promotes some of the values you're talking about. And if, you know, if there are a number of
they are members.
And they presumably in good conscience can belong, so that's a good sign that it isn't just anti-proselytizing. It might be right. Much more, as Janet was describing earlier, you know, how do you proselytize? Do you voluntarily agree that you're going to do it in a way that is civil and so forth and so on? And in that context, I think, of course, to organize people of like mind would come to that agreement, wonderful, because it promotes some of the things you're talking about in terms of dialogue and so forth. So I don't think it's the same conversation as with the student association myself. I think it's a different conversation.
What if the student association said, we'll give money to groups, including religious groups, so long as they don't proselytize?
Oh, terrible idea. Don't even say it. Well, but you know, we all proselytize and in our different ways. And it's interesting that liberal campuses that Janet described you as liberal campuses are sometimes the most intolerant of people who have deeply religious or conservative beliefs. And they say, we are intolerant in the name of tolerance. We're intolerant in the name of freedom. And it's just bizarre. But a lot of these campuses don't realize
the contradiction in their own policies when they say we're for religious freedom and we're for free speech, but we're also anti-discrimination. They don't realize that they're setting up a contradiction that isn't resolved until there's a fight or a crisis.
Dr. Turaro, you have the last question.
There is a contradiction here. The student assembly can't be money any religious groups, if it's connected to worship services. The student assembly cannot distribute money to religious groups if they're engaging in any worship or worship-related services. Yeah. CORW actually is not set up, to my mind, from the outside. I guess I'm not on the outside. But to my mind, it doesn't look like it's been set up to bring like-minded people together. It's been set up in order to take all the religious groups that engage in things like worship and proselytizing and things that are related to God and put them in one place and separate them off and just segment them off from the financial structures in which the university participates, because the university doesn't know how to justify, but more importantly, and this is why I think it's benevolent, not malevolent, it doesn't know how to assess one religious group versus another. So, you know, the student assembly can sit down and say, well, we don't have to scrutinize whether this group is good or not because there's an office that's set up that decides whether a student group can even be formed. And if the student group has already been formed, yes.
I think that's a very unwise policy. I imagine somebody who goes in to see the student group to make sure that they're not engaged in worship activities. And there's a burst of prayer that occurs. And now are you going to pull the funding? When I was on the Board of Education, we had a group whose church had been burned down. And we had a policy with respect to the schools that after school hours, any group could come in and use the facilities. I would have found a way to block the Ku Klux Klan, but somehow. But any group could come in. And this group whose church burned down wanted to use one of our buildings for Sunday morning services. And our lawyers told us, you can't do that. And I said, yes, we can. I'm a lawyer, too. They pointed to a case in the Southern District of New York, which ultimately went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, you may not distinguish between religious groups that aren't involved in worship and religious groups that are involved in worship services with respect to access to public buildings if you've opened it generally. I don't think the student assembly really wants to get in that business.
Absolutely not. And see how wonderful it is at the end we come to this great agreement? And I agree 100% with that. But I know that the time is running out, so I just want to make one other final point that hasn't come up, I think, and that is to say that we're all a minority somewhere. At Cornell, if you have a liberal outlook or a liberal religious person or a secular person, you say, well, you know, I'm at the helm here. I'm not in the hatches, like this particular group, you know, that's minority, small group. But somewhere else you're going to be in the hatches. And how you behave when you're at the helm, I'm using Roger Williams' imagery here, will determine how you're treated when you're in the hatches. And I'll just mention one example. Georgetown University, as Steve knows, had an important case along these lines a number of years ago, where the gay student group wanted to be able to form and to be treated like the other student groups at Georgetown University. It's a Catholic-related university, and the university said that would be against what we stand for. We're not going to allow this gay group to have these particular opportunities that other groups have. I mean, they can, you know, they can still meet and so forth, but really speaking, they can't have anything that the other groups have, and the gay group took it to court. Eventually they won, although the court kind of split the difference. But I think that the court, as strange as the decision is, it does point to some important values. It said, look, you know, some of these basic things that all groups have, this group should have too. But that doesn't mean that the university, Georgetown University, has to endorse the gay group. You know, the university, Georgetown's a Catholic-related university. It doesn't have to endorse a group that's advocating for gay rights if that flies in the face of what the university stands for. But as a university, if it's opened up this opportunity for various students to meet and to receive certain support to do that on the same level playing field, that doesn't, the court said, imply endorsement. That's just treating them like others. And so they do meet, and they do have a group at Georgetown. So it depends on where you are as to whether you're at the helm or in the hatches. My only argument is that wherever you are, that you remember to treat others, even those you deeply disagree with, and protect their rights, even those you deeply find, even if you find them offensive, in the same way you want your rights to be treated and respected where you're in the majority.
Let's give a hand to our panelists and moderator. For leading us into a wonderful and rich discussion this afternoon, as Charles and Steve and Janet have all lifted up for us several tensions among many, the tensions between First Amendment protections of freedom of conscience, freedom of belief, religious freedom, freedom of speech vis-a-vis the 14th Amendment commitment to equal protection under the law. The tension between, for instance, what one believes vis-a-vis how one manifests that belief. The consideration as to whether or not to subsidize speech that for instance, many would consider hateful and that targets historically oppressed groups, vis-a-vis a viewpoint that subsidies, for example, once one defines what a subsidy is, should be viewpoint neutral. These and many other considerations we've heard this evening or this afternoon implicate what constitutes inclusive human community. What kind of community do we want to be? We have been shown one way out or a possibility of a way out or a way forward toward genuine pluralism. But yet we are challenged at the same time to have the difficult and sometimes disagreeable conversations about what this means for us. But this is the messy work of what it means to be in a democracy. And this matter will become complicated all the more so when or if the time comes, for example, when or if gay rights rises to the level of what lawyers will call a compelling state interest to be protected. And then the First and 14th Amendment tensions will then be revisited all over again. So we come away from this with no easy answers. But we do, I hope, leave from this place committed to an ongoing dialogue, which is in concert with our best democratic traditions, the best traditions of Cornell, the best traditions of our own faith communities, the best traditions of our own secular form of government. Thank you for coming this afternoon and for joining us. We hope you have a good evening.